So that's why they have memory fog. The only hormone, actually, there's two hormones that go up with stress. So cortisol and insulin, and those mess you up even worse.
Right, right. And this is why we go to floor number three in your clinic and we do exercise and we meditate and we do all these things, right? Because it's never just about the hormones.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. If you're a woman on a mission working to make the world a better place, then you are in the right place. We've got your back. Before we jump into the interview, I want to invite you to join our free Facebook community, Legacy. If you want to be something amazing, you need to surround yourself with amazing people. The Legacy community is made up of badass women living, not leaving, but living our legacy every single day. We are leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, and innovators collectively committed to leaving the world better than we found it. My mission is to support the health and optimization of these badass superheroes, literally to places we never thought imaginable. If you are on a mission and get it that your health is the key to your unlimited potential, then join us. We are super awesome. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/BE Legacy. See you there. Today's episode was super fun. I was hanging out with Dr. Sherry Kaplan, a traditionally trained medical doctor from here in Toronto and someone who has come to embrace functional medicine and the role that adequately balanced hormones play in our lives. She's got an incredible clinic here in Toronto that integrates medicine and meditation and movement and exercise, all of the things that make us healthy, all under one roof. We got into the nuances of hormones, how hormones influence your neurology, your digestion, your vitality, your capacity to think clearly. And we also took a new spin on this, a spin that exists in the literature, but is very infrequently spoken about. And that is the connection between traumatic brain injuries and concussions and the influence that that has on your hormones. If you are someone who is engaging in the world, who knows people who have maybe experienced a traumatic brain injury before, have kids who are playing sports, or you yourself have ever bumped your noggin, this is an episode you need to listen to. It is something that you have probably never looked at before or heard about in your travels through health and learning more about it. And I'm really excited to share with you this really exciting interview. Dr. Sherry Kaplan. Dr. Sherry Kaplan, welcome to the Entrepology Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Walker. Thanks for inviting me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you. And I really love the stories behind the journey that takes traditionally trained physicians and introduces them to functional medicine. And I would love to hear how that transition happen. So I'm wondering if you could just start off by sharing with everybody your story. How did you get to where you are today? And then we're going to delve into the deep breadth of knowledge that you have with respect to hormones. We're going to get into the influence between hormones and brain injuries and hormones. We've got a lot to talk about today.
Sounds good. Yeah. So I always kind of joke with people. I said, what made me go over to the dark side? Or now I'll say it's the light side. But essentially, yes, I was a very conventionally trained physician, worked at both Women's College in Sunnybrook, taught residents and whatnot. And, you know, I kind of always been a little bit on the open side. I always kind of used a lot of B vitamins in my practice and vitamin D, but I really didn't have the knowledge or the understanding of why they actually help, but I clinically knew that patients felt better on those things. And then kind of for myself, what started happening is, you know, I was in my mid-40s, started all of a sudden going, you know, my brain's not working as well. And I'm like a pretty brilliant guy, girl. You sort of tell me something once, I learn it, teach it, do it, you know, kind of thing. And then it became like, oh, gee, I need to write things down. And my energy kind of changed and, you know, my weight was sort sort of being more difficult to manage. And, you know, I was like, gee, what's going on? And then I was like, oh yeah, like a lot of my patients in their 40s, they kind of come to me and they're like complaining of, you know, weight gain in the midsection and other symptoms. And I was like, ah, you're not eating right, or you're not exercising right. And, you know, but when it started happening to me, and like, I knew I was eating right and I was exercising appropriately, and it was still happening. And then the light bulb went off and it was like, ah, this must be hormones. And, you know, I come from, my mom unfortunately passed away at the age of 44 from breast cancer. And, you know, it was also not too long after the WHI study kind of came out that showed that, you know, at least that they were telling everybody that, you know, hormones increases a woman's risk of breast cancer. And so the last thing I wanted to do is take hormones and increase my risk. And it was also around the same year was the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists held a big meeting and sort of, you know, said that, you know, all hormones had the same risk. And I was at the meeting and I kind of raised my hand and I was like, wait a minute, you know, before the WHI study came out, there was some studies, you know, the PEPI trial and some other ones that were showing how natural progesterone was very different than the Provera, the synthetic form. And that, you know, I said, so has there been studies now to show that they are the same? And the comment was, no, there hasn't been. So I kind of went, wait, so how can you make a statement that every gynecologist, every family doctor is going to repeat to their patients to tell them that's the case? And so they said, oh, good question. And then I guess, oh, the light bulb went off and said, oh, there's something more here I need to learn for myself. Because also I knew that, you know, I'm only in my 40s and, you know, I have like a long life to live and I just didn't really want to live the way I was feeling. So I went off to the States and learned a lot about bioidentical hormones. And that was kind of like just the tip of the iceberg, because when I started doing training in that, I also got introduced to functional and integrative medicine. And then I kind of learned a lot about naturopathic medicine. And, you know, what I kind of really learned was, you know, hormones is one piece of the puzzle, but that, you know, there's so many other aspects of health that's really important to make someone feel well. And so that's when I started doing more training in functional integrative medicine and realized, you know, in regular medicine, you know, it's kind of band-aid or, you know, reactive to after the fact, where in, you know, functional medicine, it's kind of looking more for the root cause. And so, you know, for me, that was like, wow, I love this. And, you know, a lot of it goes back to biochemistry and genetics. And, you know, it's sort of like I can, you know, follow the links and play detective and kind of figure things out for people. And then when I started sort of incorporating that into my practice, I started seeing real shifts in my patients' health and well-being. And, you know, yes, just fixing their hormones made a big difference, but that's not like they can get so much more benefit if we sort of fix everything. And basically, you know, what do I tell people every day? Eat right, exercise, de-stress, get your sleep, exercise. Why? Because this modulates our genes and turns on good genes and turns off bad genes, and we get way better outcomes. So, you know, basically when I started practicing this type of medicine, it's very hard in the conventional system because, you know, you get paid $27 for a visit and, you know, you can't spend a lot of time sort of talking to patients about this. And it's very different talking than, you know, what most other doctors are. So I kind of had to figure out, how do I do this so that I can spend the time and get value for the time that I spend with patients. And then, so, you know, I ended up eventually creating a clinic that that I can sort of do that in. So it's a lot personalized medicine. I spend about an hour with patients, 45 minutes to follow-ups, you know, 30 to 45 minutes kind of thing on follow-up. But then I realized I needed a whole tribe or team of people to help me, because I can relay the information, but actually putting it into action needed assistance. So, you know, in the clinic that I've created, you know, we have three floors and we try to attack all of that. So like upstairs, we do Pilates, yoga, dance, bar class. Like, we want to get people moving and enjoying exercise and having fun. We have a whole cooking demo and an area to do lectures and patient education. You know, the idea is eventually to have like a community, like a night that, you know, the community comes out and sort of shares together. The main floor is sort of the more of the wellness piece. So, you know, we have the integrative and functional doctors, naturopath, chiropractic, holistic nutrition and dietitian, a weight loss program, IV therapy, kind of thing. And then in the lower level is more the detox, de-stress. So we kind of have meditation, we have massage therapy, infrared saunas, and we actually do Botox and filler as well, which is just because people, you know, feel better. We want them to feel better from the inside out, but all of it helps. So that, I guess, is sort of me in a nutshell, and why I do what why I created Vitality MD.
Well, I love it. And what's so interesting is that all of those things that you talk about that you have in the clinic are the things that we all, I feel like we kind of pass them over when we're talking about medicine sometimes. We're like, you know, you should drink water and you should move. And people are like, I know I should do those things, but how do I really fix my health? And I love that you're putting your words into action and you're really facilitating and enabling all of those things to be under one roof for people. They're all on equal footing in terms of the value and role that they play in addressing health.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what it was like. It was always, I can tell them what to do, but if they had no place to do it, now they have no excuse.
Well, yeah, right. Sometimes it's just getting started. So, you know, I have a question because I find this, you mentioned the compensation model in the traditional system with traditional medicine. And I'm always trying to understand, because I think at this point, it's really hard to debate that there's a lack of evidence for the way that you're practicing or the way that I'm practicing. There's an abundance of evidence for it at this point.
Right.
Do you think if there was a compensation model, and sure, we're maybe talking about the Canadian system here, but if there was a compensation model that actually adequately compensated physicians for implementing these types of changes or having a team that assisted in the implementation of these changes, do you think there'd be faster adoption of this systems-based approach as opposed to this siloed approach that we've built our healthcare model around?
I think the answer is yes and no. So yes, if physicians got compensated enough for this type of medicine, that more physicians would do it. But part of the thing is, if you think about it, most family doctors have 2,000 or 3,000, if not more, patients in their practice. And if you're now going from a 5-minute visit or a 15-minute visit, and now you're creating an hour visit and 45-minute follow-ups, how does the population get served? Now, you could sort of say, well, if I'm spending that time preventatively, then maybe down the road, there'll be a lot less visits required and things will balance out. But you can sort of see how do people make that shift. And also the doctors need that education piece, mm-hmm. which doesn't just happen overnight. Like that's right. Taken me kind of years. And what I find, medicine is changing so rapidly that like I find I'm having a hard time keeping up, you know, and it's like every day there's something new. Oh, did you know that? And most doctors don't spend the time.
Yeah. And well, they don't have the time.
Correct.
Yeah. That's absolutely part of it. So there's really, from your perspective, there's an operational issue, but there's also a philosophical barrier that we need to get beyond. And that just requires time and exposure.
Right. But I think if we all went that way, that at the end of the day, we would probably save a lot of health lives and people would feel significantly better. And eventually all those visits, you know, of acute care medicine would be substantially reduced.
Yeah, you know, I had an experience in clinic this month, and there was a patient who had, you know, gone through a really significant health issue, and the health issues sort of started acutely after the person went on a gluten-free and dairy-free diet, and this individual ended up in the hospital. And so the only logical conclusion that the medical team could come to was, this health crisis must have been caused by the absence of gluten and dairy from your diet. And it took so much effort, right? So I was like, well, first of all, like we all know correlation doesn't mean causation, but I was like, man, this isn't, you know, I didn't blame that team. I was like, this is a huge issue in terms of access to appropriate information, because people don't get acutely ill when you move their diet towards a healthier place. And she compensated for the lack of dairy and gluten in an appropriate way. But, you know, my biggest concern was like, oh man, are we still here? Like that just, as someone who has a science background, and anyone practicing medicine has some element of a science background, that's just a really faulty logical conclusion to come to, let alone when we have talented clinicians who are working.
It's almost like saying, oh, let's remove the mercury from your diet or your environment, and then you get sick and you're no, mercury is actually really good for you.
Yeah, we're going to supplement you on mercury. I had a hard time holding it together, but it was a really good example of where we are just not there yet from a philosophical perspective, which is frankly why I appreciate the work that you do.
Thank you
so much. So, you know, one of the things that we're hearing a lot about in the media lately, and I'm so glad this conversation is happening, is around this concept of traumatic brain injuries. And we have all sorts of initiatives taking place in sports activities for kids. And I find, even in the parlance of my practice, I'm finding more and more patients are like, listen, I've had a traumatic brain injury. Whereas before we would just kind of like, oh, I hit my head a few years ago, and we wouldn't think anything of it. But what I've heard you speak about before is the connection between traumatic brain injuries or concussions or getting hit on the head and hormonal dysfunctions. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I feel like this is an area of the conversation that very few people have had exposure to.
Because I guess, like, you know, my basis for what I do, I start with hormones. I then, you know, started doing some training in the States again on traumatic brain. And the things that, that a lot of people don't appreciate. So I think conventional medicine is getting really good at identifying, okay, yeah, you had a significant concussion or head trauma, and you know, you're having headaches, dizziness, and whatnot, and they might get some help and, you know, at least validate the patient to sort of say, yeah, you have something. Or, you know, these athletes who get repeated concussions, head injuries, and now we have a diagnosis of CTE. And, you know, we know that from that there's, you know, mood problems, a whole bunch of health problems that can happen. And that's how a lot of, you know, NHL player, but the football players and whatnot, that they, you know, more likely to commit suicide or abuse and all this other stuff because of their chronic head injuries. But conventional medicine, like, okay, they're like, okay, yeah, you've got a diagnosis, but they really don't have any real plan on how to treat it. And what we're learning is that you can have, with a concussion, a whiplash, even with severe emotional physical trauma, you can actually get damage in the brain where the communication, the axons, either degenerate or are fractured, and you may not pick that up on any regular imaging. I mean, there is some like high tensilon MRIs that will show these axonal damages, but when you have those damages, the, you know, hypothalamus, pituitary may not speak to each other, and that normal feedback may not be normal. And so if you're not thinking about head injury when you're looking at someone's hormones, you may miss, because a lot of times they're looking at either the pituitary hormones, and if you had head trauma, you know, they might actually be, you know, not like, I'll give you an example for TSH. So if that's for thyroid, so usually it's, you know, you look at the TSH, and if it rises, if it's elevated, it means you're hypothyroid. But if someone actually had a head trauma, that TSH actually be low. And if you're not ordering that free T3 and free T4, which is the active, like, you know, the actual hormones, and see that they're actually low, you can then say, oh, there's a communication problem. The body, the brain is not sensing what the body's doing. So it's kind of a looking for, you know, the brain hormones and the end organ hormones is important. And also some people, when they have these head traumas and these axons could be damaged, that their hormones tend to be lower. And then fortunately, you know, in some cases it's very obvious if they're outside the normal range, but sometimes they're just low normal, and that, you know, by optimizing them, putting back into a much better reference range, people feel better. And I'm going to come back to why, if their hormones are better, That's important. But so that's one piece of what happens when you have a head injury, is that those hormones can be disrupted. And in fact, there's chapters in medical textbooks showing that with head trauma, you can actually have hormonal disruption. Yet most doctors are not actually even looking at clients' hormones. And it's not just the sex hormones, but it's really like, you know, all the hormones can be off whack because of this. So that's one piece. And then the second piece is that when you whack your head, you actually set up an inflammatory cascade, and that there's the initial inflammatory cascade. And then there's a secondary cascade that can happen and actually go on for years. And so if we're not, you know, trying to reduce that inflammation or stop the pathways, you can actually have sequela from that head injury, not just within that immediate time, but a year later, 2 years later, or significantly years later. So, and then the third piece of that is that there are people who are genetically predisposed, that when they have a head injury, that they're more likely to have sequela. So these are people who have genetic SNPs related to methylation in B12, to their vitamin D receptor, and some other ones. And so really what we should be doing with our young athletes is actually doing their genetic testing ahead of time, figure out which of those individuals are more at risk, and making sure when they're playing that they have appropriate levels of vitamin D, they're on a B vitamin, and they have omega. And in fact, well, you can sort of say, okay, well, it's expensive to do genetic testing, so why don't we make sure that our, you know, athletes at any age are on this regularly? Not only will they help prevent the damage from a head injury, but they actually have a lot of other health and wellness pieces for many other things like mood and energy and whatnot. So that's kind of another neat little piece.
That's really interesting. I genetic testing is expensive, but so is every recreational activity you sign your kid up for.
True.
So if it's a matter of doing $250 worth of genetic testing and understanding what these SNPs are and what to do with them versus managing chronic sequelae because your daughter is heading a soccer ball every week, this sounds like a really, really good investment.
I think so. You know, but the thing is, a lot of people don't, like, you know, especially in the Canadian health system, you know, the belief is I don't have to pay for healthcare, it's free, so why should I spend money? Kind of thing. And I kind of say, like, you know, if you invest in your health, that's like the best asset that you'll ever have, because you'll feel better, you'll be more productive and whatnot. And yeah, like, you know, who wants a kid who, you know, now can't concentrate in school, has more ADD, mood problems, because they've been whacking their head with the soccer ball on a weekly basis and they weren't protected.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think sometimes what happens is we get this new information and it sort of becomes this inconvenient truth, right? Because when we know better, we do better. And now we're having this whole conversation about not just how do we prevent those head injuries, but how do we prevent the sequelae of an inevitable head injury. And it starts to open a box for people. So are there things that we can just do in our everyday life to decrease that risk? In the absence of genetic testing, and I don't mean decrease your risk for head injuries, because frankly, those seem to happen, you know, when you least expect it.
Right. But what I would sort of say is there's plenty of science now to show that people who are playing sports more likely to hit their heads is that they should be on a good B, specifically B12 and B6, and that omega has a lot of protective benefits, and making sure your vitamin D is in the normal range. So, and that dose would be different for everybody, but that's a cheap blood test to do once a year or whatever. So just those three things alone would significantly improve the outcome of any head injury. And actually the other piece of it is, if you actually have a head injury, is actually high dose omega for a month and make sure you're on those Bs and that vitamin D is optimal. It actually reduces, again, the inflammatory process and really kind of helps reduce the sequela. So yeah, it's kind of cool what we could do, but unfortunately the information is not out there. And yes, great, we're, you know, having students go and do this pre, concussion assessment so they know their baseline. Big whoop. I want to know, like, what do I do to prevent it and how do I prevent damage once it's happened, right? So that's, I think, a really cool piece. And, you know, this is such an easy implementation. It's not expensive and has many other health benefits. So that's one thing. And then the other piece that, like, you know, I want to get into talking about is how the hormones play into this and why is it important to have your hormones at optimal levels. And really, hormones actually, so yes, we make hormones in our periphery, but it actually, there's literature now to suggest that all our neurons have the ability to synthesize every hormone. So they can make estrogen, testosterone, DHEA, pregnenolone, progesterone, and whatnot. And they actually do this on a regular basis. And basically, they're called neurosteroids, whereas the other hormones are, you know, kind of just, they call them general steroids because they're more in the body. So neuro means the brain. So that our brain cells can make de novo neurosteroids. They can make hormones in your brain all by themselves with their building blocks. And we actually do this. But when you have a head injury, inflammation shuts down that ability to make the hormones. Why is hormones in the brain important? Each hormone has a function in the brain. So estrogen actually is involved with two neurotransmitters, acetylcholine and serotonin. So when you have less estrogen, so not only because now you had a head trauma, but also you happen to be perimenopausal, menopausal, or something else, premature ovarian failure or whatever, you now lack peripheral estrogen and central estrogen. And estrogen also protects the mitochondria. It helps reduce Alzheimer's. And basically, when acetylcholine's low, that's your concentration and memory kind of thing. And you know, serotonin is your happy neurotransmitter. So if you're low, you're more likely to get depressed. And then, sorry, you're going to ask me something.
No, I'm going to ask you like 500 things. So here's the situation I keep seeing in my patients is that we have an epidemic in our society where people are stressed out. They're caught in this fight or flight state at all times. So their sympathetic nervous system is just in
overdrive.
It's overdrive all the time.
And actually, what does that do to your hormones?
Exactly.
It suppresses all of them. So that's why they have memory fog. The only hormone, actually, there's two hormones that go up with stress. So cortisol and insulin, and those mess you up even worse.
Right. Right.
Yes.
And so, this is why we go to floor number 3 in your clinic and we do exercise and we meditate and we do all these things, right? Because it's never just about the hormones.
Correct. So anyway, I'll come back to what are other things that affect our hormones, and we'll talk about how all these other pieces affect it. But so that's your estrogen piece, and progesterone, believe it or not, makes new neurons, and it also binds to the GABA receptor, which is your natural Ativan or tranquilizer and sleep aid. So a lot of women, you know, when they're going through perimenopause, they're usually low on progesterone because it's one of the first hormones to go out the window. And what do they find? They're getting more anxious. Irritable, they're not sleeping. And really, what do? They go to their doctor now and they're like, oh, here's your sleeping pill or your anti-anxiety medicine kind of thing. But really, what they need to replace is their progesterone. And in, you know, there's the Protect 1 and 2 trial that, you know, in acute head injury, they actually gave IV progesterone to both men and women, and they actually gave it in whopping doses. And in the Protect 1, it actually showed reduced, morbidity and mortality. And then unfortunately in the Protect 2, we didn't really sort of see the exact same thing. But again, you know, medicine is really good. It's always picking one thing at sort of looking at, but really causes
only
and
one
problems
thing goes
and
wrong
it's multifactorial.
Of course,
so that's why I don't think we're all genetically different. So that's about progesterone. And then testosterone also increases concentration connectivity between the brain. And DHEA cleans up the junk in the brains. And it's also has to do with our immune system in the brain. And so, you know, basically when you have a head injury, you're losing your hormones in the brain. So that loses, what do the hormones do? They help with repair and regeneration. The more hormones that we have, the more stem cells we have. What do stem cells do, right? They repair and regenerate. So, you know, so basically someone who has a head injury and happens to also either be stressed, that's also going to reduce all their hormones, or their perimenopause, menopause, or men going through andropause, you know, so they are getting that double whammy, and then there's that whole inflammatory process. So which also will reduce hormones. So basically what happens is what happens when people have low testosterone in a man, an example, I mean, there's plenty of data to show that increases the risk of depression and insomnia. There's studies on low DHEA and again, the psych literature showing depression and anxiety. So each hormone, when it's deficient, could actually present, and fatigue can be one of those great things that it presents with, because again, all those hormones are off. So it's really important to, when someone has a head injury, to address the inflammation piece, but also address the hormone piece. And so really looking at the labs and looking where people are falling in the range, and are they at the top end, the middle end, or the low end? And so, you know, it is important sometimes just to adjust where you are in the range. And a perfect example is, you know, for thyroid is, you know, our range goes from 0.5 to 5. I guess, like, we know that if we actually decide we're going to give someone thyroid medicine, that when we're actually replacing thyroid, we know that being having a TSH between 0.5 and 1.5, maybe up to 2, women feel better. But so why is it then when they go to their doctor and they look and they're 3.5, they're like, ah, you're fine. And also we know for fertility, to reduce the risk of miscarriages and effect on IQ on babies, that we want that woman's TSH to be between 0.5 and max 2.5. But why again, any other time do we say, okay, you can be as high as 5?
And so, in terms of, I just want to jump in terms of the assessment of these hormones, are you talking about like the traditional blood work that individuals would have done with their primary care provider, running your TSH, running blood values of estrogen and progesterone? Or are you looking at these numbers and analyzing these values through a different testing mechanism?
So basically, I tend to look through blood first always. And again, you know, most family doctors aren't really ordering estrogen, progesterone, FSH, and LH. Maybe they'll order that when the woman, they just want to, oh, is the woman menopausal, right? But really, like, you know, don't forget these hormones flux throughout the cycle. And also, you know, depending on what month you do it, you know, in a perimenopausal, you might see very menopausal levels, and then another time see really high hormones. So it's kind of appreciating what that person's going through by also listening to the story. But also with regard to thyroid, a lot of doctors tend to just order TSH, where you kind of want to look, especially in a head injury, you want to look at TSH, but also T3 and T4. And I like to look at thyroid antibodies, because when thyroid antibodies are high, guess what's the new information? Is that you can actually have antibodies against your brain. And so that's where their mood and their energy and all this other stuff. And in fact, you know, when you have antibodies attacking the brain, you actually set up the immune system to cause more inflammation. And I already told you, when you have inflammation in the brain, causes a whole bunch of problems and reduces all the other hormones too.
Well, so, yeah. And when you have inflammation in the brain and you have challenges in the brain, you inevitably, we have a whole other axis here that we haven't even gotten into. And I just have to have this pause moment where I'm like, look, see, biology and physiology and human health is a systems-based thing. It's not a silo-based
exactly.
way of looking at it. But if we've got issues that are happening in the brain, if we've got depression, we've got low hormones, then what we're also going to see are changes that are happening in the gut and with digestion. What is the role that a healthy gut has to play in terms of hormonal regulation and balance?
Well, I basically, you know, the term now is gut inflammation, brain inflammation, or we are always talking about that gut-brain connection. So, you know, I think, again, conventional medicine is not really looking at that. Maybe some people are just kind of starting that because, you know, they've done the microbiome and they've looked at when the microbiota is messed up that people tend to have more depression or other issues. So that's kind of along the conventional medicine side, but really in functional medicine, you know, the gut health is so important because, again, when we have inflammation in the gut, and so we talk about leaky gut, but basically the blood-brain barrier is very equivalent to the gut lining. So if you have a leaky gut, you have a high likelihood of leaky brain, or, you know, the leaky brain barrier. And so when your brain's the barrier is leaky, more toxins are able to go up in the brain. And that, again, that inflammatory cascade. And, you know, having... we actually have more neurotransmitters in our gut than, I mean, especially when it comes to serotonin, than we do in our brain. So how many people, you know, their gut's inflamed and they feel their mood could be off. So we see that a lot of people with Crohn's or ulcerative colitis may have mood problems. And how many of us, when we're stressed and worry, our bowels act up. So there is this huge communication between the two. And unfortunately, in today's world, you know, we eat the SAD diet, the standard American diet that makes us all mad or depressed or whatnot. You know, we're eating way too much gluten, and the gluten of today is very inflammatory. So again, causes inflammation, and that has nothing to do with celiac. It's just gluten in general has data now to show that it opens up those tight junctions. You know, and then unfortunately our food supply has, you know, a lot of herbicides and pesticides and also glyphosates, which again mess up our gut bacteria and causes inflammation and stimulates our immune system. And I didn't appreciate that. How do we set up autoimmunity? And it's about basically toxins and lipopolysaccharides, which happen to be these bacterial endotoxins that, again, when we have leaky gut, they go into our bloodstream much faster. And basically in the lab, how do we set up an autoimmune scenario is basically we inject these lipopolysaccharides plus or minus a little toxin, and then boom, that rat has an autoimmune condition, and now they can study lupus or whatever. So I'm like, shit, you know, that we're being exposed every day, and no wonder autoimmunity seems to be going up.
Okay, so here's what's happening with people listening right now is they're going, oh my God.
Okay, that's overload. I'm sorry.
No. They're like, I walk out the door and my whole system's bombarded, and like, help me if I hit my head on a fire extinguisher at some point today, because I don't know how I'm going to recover, which I also know and appreciate is not, is totally not, where you're coming from. And what's really cool about you is, you're a really healthy person, and you go out and you live your life, and you'll go out on a Saturday night and you'll enjoy yourself. So what are if we could pick three things that people could do to really help counterbalance these new pressures as we engage in the world that aren't necessarily supplements, like, just what are like three things people could do that just help decrease the pressure on their system on a daily basis? What would you suggest?
Well, basically I think that eating healthy is number one. Right. And, you know, everybody has a definition of what eating healthy is, but essentially I would sort of say, you know, trying not to eat processed food, more whole foods, going back to eating protein, fruits and vegetables, all colors of the rainbow, you know, trying to avoid trans fats, high fructose corn syrup. So I'll just try to make it really basic. So just eating, like, you know,
real
off
food.
The land, right? Yeah. Real food, right? So that in itself, and again, incorporating more organic will help reduce our toxic exposure to glyphosates and herbicides and pesticides and yada, yada. So that is just like one basic thing. And then, you know, part of that eating healthy, I would say that gluten isn't our friend. So, you know, making that shift can make huge benefits for so many health problems. So I would say that's number one. Number two is managing our stress. And why? Because when we manage our stress, our hormone balance for all the hormones are actually better. You know, when we're less stressed, our gut bacteria actually is better, because when you're stressed, you throw them off and it can cause leaky gut too. So how do we reduce our stress? Well, that could be exercise, that could be meditation, that could be going for massage, learning to say no, you know. So there's all those pieces that can be quite helpful. And then I guess that third thing for me would be, I always say, balance your hormones, replace deficient nutrients, so your body works more effectively. And so kind of doing those three things will make the huge shifts in your health and longevity. So, and I don't think they're all that difficult to do. And it's not like, oh my God, tomorrow I'm changing everything I do. Because that's too hard. Like if you sort of start, okay, this is my goal. What am I going to do? What shift can I make this week and kind of work in that direction? You know, that's going to be something that you can sustain for your lifetime. And the more you get in a habit of doing something, you're likely to continue to do it.
Such good advice. Sherry, you have so much information. It's amazing. What do you want your legacy to be?
I think my legacy is really to get the word out and how important doing all this is, and, you know, for our health. And that, you know, I'm, you know, basically my legacy is that I shifted people's health for the better.
Amazing.
And that I made a difference.
So true, right? If we could all just get up and want to make a difference, the world would be a different place. How do you define health?
So most people would say it's the absence of disease, but that's not what I say. I would say health is about feeling vital, energetic, you know, full of life and, you know, want to go, but not go. So we're so stressed.
Yeah. A little bit of a balance on the go.
Yeah.
Each month, I'm featuring a new Anthropology quiz to help you unlock and uncover some of the physical performance blocks that may be holding you back from your true potential. When you know better, you can do better. To learn more or to take the quiz, head on over to meganwalker.com/Anthropology quiz. This is a great place to transition to the last few questions that we have in the interview. And this second part I call our KPIs, our key performance indicators. So just like we would have these numbers in our business, I believe we also have these indicators in our health. So I've got six quick rapid fire questions for you related to your world and your health and your congruency in terms of how you live. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay. Don't worry. There's nothing too revealing. Okay. Question one, do you have a consistent morning routine? And if so, can you share?
Yes. So basically I get up every morning, I meditate for about 20 minutes and I happen to pull an oracle card that sort of gives me information about the day. So it's kind of a neat, fun thing. And it's kind of doing psychotherapy through it. So
it's awesome. I love it. Fiction or nonfiction? What are you reading right now?
I wish I would say nonfiction, but I would sort of say reading medical and naturopathic and wellness articles and listening to podcasts is my porn.
Yeah, I get it. That's basically everyone's answer on this podcast. What is the one thing you are most consistent with respect to your health?
Well, eating healthy and exercising. Like I do, you know, Pilates springboard all the time and I love it. It's my de-stress.
And what is something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
I don't know.
That's a secret.
Well, I would sort of say that I practice what I preach and patients come to me year after year and they're like, I don't get it. You look younger every year that I see you. And I tell them like, I'm like a fine wine. I get better with time.
It's amazing. What do you do for fun or play?
Pilates, springboard, snowboarding.
Snowboarding. That's a little bit badass. We could have pulled that in.
Yes.
I like it. Last question for you. Entrepreneurism. Are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
I think there's part of it is that there's an instinct and a drive that has to be there to begin with. But I think that we learn along the way and find our passion.
Such a good answer. And I find that's so true. When you are compelled enough and you know where you want to go and what you want to deliver, then you find a way. And entrepreneurism is often it. Dr. Kaplan, it was a real pleasure having you on the podcast today. I know people are going to want to follow up and learn more about what you are doing. We'll have all of this information in our show notes, but where can people find you and see a little bit more about what you're up to?
So basically, I'm the founder of Vitality MD. It's 1769 Avenue Road. Our website is vitalitymd.com. I do a segment on Ask the Doctor on our Facebook page weekly. So it's usually a 5 to max 10 minute video on something about our health and how we can improve it. And then I think Instagram is, or Facebook is vitalitymdtour.com.
Amazing.
Vitality MD Tour. Sorry.
Don't worry. We'll have all of the links. They'll be set and right, and they'll be in our show notes. Dr. Kaplan, thanks so much for being here. It was a real pleasure having you today.
Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.